appreciate people coming. First item on the agenda is adoption of committee rules.
So,
you guys have received your packets. The rules should look pretty familiar. They're, you know, kind of standard for supplemental and real processes. Mr. Rocco, you have any comments on the rules at all for us?
Mr. Chair, the rules are, as you mentioned, they're standard for the Ways and Means Committee. The only change that we've done from the regular session rules is eliminated any references to subcommittees, since the committee is going to function as a committee of the whole.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. President, Mr. Speaker. That's actually, you know, lack of space. It's lack of space. Anyway.
Co-chair.
Yes, ma'am.
I move that the committee adopt the rules as presented.
Motion's been made. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none, so ordered. All right. Next, we're going to have Mr. Rocco discuss a little bit about where we are in the process, and then I'll talk a little bit about, actually, we'll see what he says, and may not talk at all. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have today the copies of the bill drafts that you recommended for introduction for this session. There are four bills that are the Ways and Means bills, and they are Senate Bill 5555, which is the capital construction bill, Senate Bill 5556, which is the budget reconciliation bill, which will include most of the budget changes that the committee approves, and we anticipate doing that in an amendment later this month. House Bill 5100, which is the bonding authority bill, and House Bill 3626, which is a program change bill. Currently, these bills have all of the items that the interim committee approved, recommended to this committee, be included in that bill in your October and December meetings. And we're currently working on an amendment for each of these bills that would incorporate all of the items that you approved in January. As you approve things during this month, we will continue to add that to the amendment so that on the 20th or the 21st of this month, when the committee needs to close, you will have the full set of amendments of all the things that you have approved to that point. As far as the next couple of days, tomorrow the schedule is going to be primarily Department of Education issues. On Thursday, we are looking at a report from the Oregon Student Assistance Commission on the shared responsibility model. We have a limitation increase for a grant that the Criminal Justice Commission received that was previously approved. You're going to receive a report from the Parks and Recreation Department on their 0709 rebounds plan. And then starting around 4:30, we have posted for some public testimony for the remainder of that meeting on Thursday for comments on these four bills as they currently stand. Then we anticipate trying to get to you by Thursday a weekly calendar so that you have an idea of what we had planned for the following week. And the reason is we have limited number of meetings, and we're trying to squeeze a very large number of items into these 11 meetings that the committee has. So we're trying to juggle things to make sure that everything gets heard. And so we're going to try to get you at least a week's notice on items, with the understanding that we may have to juggle schedules as things don't get done or other things pop up.
Thank you. So in other words, we're going to hopefully give you guys a week's calendar in advance, subject to change. There'll be public testimony pretty much every hearing, generally following the topics of the day. If we're doing education or human services that day, there may be an opportunity for some invited testimony. The co-chairs are trying to work that out. And hopefully next day or so we'll get that first iteration to you and to everyone else out there. Questions about where we're going? Then we'll probably ask for questions again after you actually get the calendar in front of you and want to really ask questions. Yes, Madam Co-Chair.
Just to be clear on public testimony, We have specifically asked Mr. Rocco to set aside an hour or more, depending on how lengthy the committee discussion is on the items on Thursday's agenda. But we'd like to have at least an hour, perhaps a bit more, of public testimony. We've said on the bills that are identified here, but essentially what that means, colleagues, is on all the issues that might come before us. We also want to have some portion of each meeting available for testimony. We are trying to have much of that be public testimony, but there may be a few days when to focus our attention, and because we've already had a lot of public testimony, we will limit it to invited testimony. We will let you know as we work that out what to expect and invite your input on that schedule. But since we're a committee of the whole, this is the only opportunity for us to have public testimony, and we want to make sure we have access for the public to give us their thoughts. Having said that, we're anticipating that we will run that public testimony comment in much the same way that we ran the public hearings that we held in different cities around the state. So there will be time limits, and we will probably be sticking with the same kind of time limit of 3 minutes per speaker. We will probably also attempt to make sure that that the committee benefits from a diversity of input. So we don't know exactly how we're going to do that, but it probably won't be just a first-come, first-speaks arrangement, because otherwise we could fill up the entire hour with testimony on only one topic and then deny the committee members the benefit of hearing about other topics. So if you have suggestions on how we might do that, we'd welcome that as well.
Very good. Further comments at this time? Seeing none, let's go on to work session on Senate Bill 5556. That's our budget bill. For inclusion, some discussion about the 30-year land use review, finally known as Big Luck at the department, if they don't mind to come on up. We talked about this before at our previous Ways and Means hearing. We won't be making a decision today. Obviously, we don't have the forecast. We outlined some scenarios. We expect the department to have some questions for us based on the scenarios outlined yesterday, and you too, for that matter, members of the body here. They've worked hard, as I understand, in the interim to match up with our at least steady scenario and see if there's a possibility of doing some good work there. Staff, do you have any comments at this point?
Only that you have included in your agenda packet a memo from the Legislative Fiscal Office, which outlines the interim joint committee work, and then some brief ideas on how the agency has reduced the consultant fee, but it would come better from the agency because they did work very hard to get that cost down from $600,000 to $400,000.
I really appreciate their efforts personally. Please begin.
If I may, Chair Schrader, Chair Thorne, members of the committee, my name is Steve Clark. I'm a resident of Tigard, president of the Portland Tribune and Community Newspapers, and a member of the Oregon Task Force on Land Use Planning. We'd like to thank the Ways and Means Committee and the individual members for their continued interest and investment in Oregon's future, and in this case, specifically in Oregon's land use future. I'd like the committee to know that members of the task force and the department staff, as you have indicated, have worked hard over the last several weeks to pare the budget, to create, as we had intended before, a work plan and an engagement process that engages Oregonians throughout the state in a variety of direct forms of citizen involvement, citizen education, and a process of evaluation of Oregon's land use system as we know it today and as we imagine it for the next 30 or more years. This is really the intent of the legislature when it authorized Senate Bill 82, and we are energized and committed to carry out your work that you authorized us to do and really request your funding to allow us to proceed. While the time is short, the requirements of Senate Bill 82 and the opportunity before us is essential. That citizen engagement process requires your support and our energy, and over the next several months, the next 10 months, the work of all Oregonians. What Richard Whitman will outline for you is a process where we will take ourselves out to engage thousands of Oregonians in their communities in all regions of the state. And as I said, while time is short, what we are committed to do is return to the 2009 Oregon Legislature, and actually before that, with the evaluation that Oregonians have participated in, with a series of thoughtful discussions from prioritized recommendations that the 2009 Oregon Legislature will consider and we hope would adopt. We are prepared to not just engage stakeholders, but all Oregonian stakeholders, elected leadership and appointed leadership throughout the state, and really legislators in their community. And as I said, we thank you for your interest in the subject and hopefully for your financial support in allowing us to complete our job and provide recommendations to the O9 session. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve, and thank you, co-chairs, for this opportunity to come back and talk to you some more about the process for re-engaging the Big Look Task Force. For the record, Richard Whitman from the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I want to start out by giving you apologies from Mike Thorne, the chair of the Big Look Task Force, and Commissioner Witte, the co-chair of the task force. They would have, I think, liked to have participated in this discussion today, but we didn't have a whole lot of notice to get here. So, Mr. Clark, has put in a lot of effort working with the chair and co-chair to come up with an evaluation of what we can do under different funding scenarios for re-engagement of the task force. So let me walk you through briefly the work program for the task force and more specifically the public outreach and engagement program that we've worked with the consultants and the leadership of the task force to come up with. Before I get into the detail, we believe we can make this work for the amount of funding that legislative fiscal has recommended in the report, but just barely. The proposal that I'm going to describe to you is lean and mean, and it is aggressive in terms of the outreach effort, but it required some real significant cuts in dollars going to the consultants. It also is requiring a significant commitment on the part of the Department of Land Conservation and Development to work with the task force to help support the public engagement and education evaluation program that faces the task force over the next 9 months. So there have been some big gulps by both the department and the consultants to try to make this work, but I think we put together a program that is workable. So the first step of the work program moving forward, assuming legislative funding, is to take the preliminary evaluation and recommendations that the task force prepared last year and put those in a form where the task force can start having one-on-one discussions with particular stakeholder interest, a broad range of about 30 different stakeholder groups throughout the state, different types of interest, and refine those recommendations into a prioritized set of what are the issues that our land use program should be grappling with for the next 30 years, and what are the alternative ways that the land use system might be set up to do that. And to then come up with those alternatives along with an evaluation of the existing program and how effective that has been in achieving the original goals of the land use program, and take that package out to a series of audiences around the state, audiences including the general public through newspaper, through newspaper inserts, through a series of regional meetings, through a series of smaller meetings that will be done by, to some extent, by volunteers, by some extent, by individual task force members, in getting out and laying out those alternatives at a broad scale to the public, a little bit more focused to some of the civic and business groups around the state, and get both that broad scale feedback and engagement and understanding of what the issues are from the public, so we get that discussion going, and then get more targeted, specific engagement and feedback from some of the smaller groups. That effort will is planned to occur during the summer and early fall. And one of the difficulties here, obviously, is the task force has been on a hiatus for the last 6 months, and we're now looking at trying to still meet the objective here of getting recommendations to the 09 Legislative Assembly, and also recognizing the reality that this is a presidential election year. And so we're going to be trying to go out with this broad-scale engagement outreach effort during the summer and very early part of the fall, and try to get that completed and put to bed before we really get into the election season. And then take that period in late September and October and work to refine and revise and do some further prioritization of what the recommendations are by the task force. A lot of that involves not just task force work, but again going back to the stakeholder groups, taking what the task force has learned from its engagement program back to the stakeholder groups and getting their feedback as well into refining this. So that what then comes to the 09 Legislative Assembly is a pretty finely honed set of prioritized recommendations for what are the big issues that our land use system should be set up to deal with for the next 30 years. What's the structure of that system? And some specific recommendations on how to get there. So that is the program. There are a lot of, when you get down into the detail of this, there are a lot of meetings planned. There are, again, broad-scale meetings in different regional locations around the state, but perhaps more importantly, there are as many as 50 smaller-scale meetings with smaller groups also scattered throughout the state. So this is not just taking the task force out in a caravan and meeting at various locations around the state. This is a campaign to try to get out to, as I said, different audiences, get them engaged in what these issues are, and get their feedback for what the land use program should look like in the long term. Part of that is also coordination of these meetings with a very aggressive media campaign. The newspaper inserts, that form of media will be coordinated with the meetings so that we hit target audiences in advance of the meetings occurring in that part of the state, and try to get people informed and excited about some of the discussion that's going to occur at some of these meetings. So it's all interwoven. The last thing I'd like to just touch on is that we're now at the budget level proposed by legislative fiscal of a total of $750,000. We're now at about $400,000 below what the task force and the governor identified as necessary for this effort last summer. So the amount of funding proposed to do this, although we are doing it in a shorter period of time, we're doing it with substantially less money than was initially identified by the task force as necessary to do this job. So I feel good about the program that we've come up with working with the consultants. I think it can be effective, but if we start looking at any further reductions in this, we're really starting to, you're going to have to take entire elements out of the program at this point. Okay. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that committee members may have.
Very good, thank you. Yes, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. As it happens, I'm the founder and CEO of a market research firm, so I have a couple of questions about methodology. First of all, what's the estimated sample size? Approximately how many folks are you going to talk to at these meetings?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Edwards, we anticipate that through the large meetings and the smaller, what we would call meetings in a box, where we'd visit with incremental units of, say, 50 to 75 people, mm-hmm. we'll be able to attract the engagement of up to 10,000 Oregonians. The newspaper inserts, which we would replay the direct attendance to those meetings as they occur in different regions, would reach approximately 600,000 newspaper subscribers, which would drive knowledge and readership, hopefully, of approximately 1.2 to 1.3 million Oregonians. The website, it's hard to judge that, but we would post information on the website and attendance opportunities at all of these community meetings throughout the next 8 to 10 months. Our meetings are open to the public, and we promote them actively. The public opinion research that we would propose to do would be a statistically valid non-respondent survey. So we would intend to survey the respondents that we would call randomly, mm-hmm. 450 to 500 Oregonians. If we are able, we would try to do some voting on site for participants, but that in itself is an expense, and how we can afford that we're attempting to determine. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Quick follow-up.
Please.
So just to reiterate, there'll be two separate ways you'll capture and analyze the information. On the one hand, you'll have kind of informal qualitative feedback at the meetings, and on the other, you'll do some quantitative assessment via a random digit dial telephone studies.
Okay.
That is correct. Great. Thanks.
Very good. Good questions. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Kocher. Thank you for the great work that you've done. I really appreciate the thoughtful approach to this. I think in order for the big look to the outcome of the process to be really embraced by Oregonians, Oregonians are going to have to be convinced that there was a real effort made to reach all Oregonians. Do you have any information that details where the meetings are going to be geographically? And just a more detail about when in time each of these pieces is going to take place, where the public meetings are going to be, that kind of detailed information.
Chair Schrader, Representative Morgan, in terms of the regional meetings around the state, the plan is to have 10 large-scale meetings around the state, so 10 different regions spread geographically throughout the state. The exact locations of those haven't been planned yet, but they would be occurring in the late July, August, or early September time frame. And as I indicated, the timing of this is difficult because of the other things going on in the fall. But I think we'll try to be sensitive in the timing of those to the fact that, you know, people during the summer will be out on vacation. So we'll try to set up the timing as best we can to squeeze them into that probably narrow window in September to get as much attendance as we can at them.
May I ask a follow-up, Mr. Kocher?
Yes.
When you say that you've divided the state into regions, how have you regionalized it? What's the criteria?
So, Chair Schrader, Representative Morgan, we have not divided, and the task force has not divided the state into any particular regions. The idea here is just part of the charge of Senate Bill 82 is to look at different areas of the state and needs of different areas of the state in terms of the land use system. So there's no formulaic regionalization that has been done by the task force to divide the state up. This is simply the mechanics of having enough meetings in different parts of the state to make sure that we hear that input in terms of what some of the particular problems of different areas of the state are. So there's no set agenda in terms of what specific regions will be.
May I make a comment? I appreciate the thoughtfulness of how you're expressing this, but let me just kind of cut to the chase here, because I think that the great fear, especially on the part of people in the rural parts of the state, are that they're going to be passed over in this discussion. And there, it's no secret that part of the shortcomings of the land use system that we have is that it's applied across the state to very differing circumstances on the ground. And I think that in order that there is a meaningful discussion in the rural parts of the state, I would very strongly urge you not to shortchange that part of the discussion. It's a passionate issue for rural Oregonians. And I think that the issues and the potential solutions are going to look different than they are for the urban parts of the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, one way that we've considered doing this is to ask to be invited. For example, there are bodies of work in the state that some may say work well, the area commissions or committees on transportation. And so if, for example, we were hosted throughout the state by existing bodies of work that are not, in this case, specific to transportation, but could serve as a host throughout all of Oregon, that what we're able to do is come to the communities that you describe as being so essential and invite Oregonians to that location. And again, it would not be the committee, in this case, the Area Committee on Transportation, that would be doing the work or talking specifically about transportation. Be a known body that of Oregonians in that community where people are comfortable gathering and talking about important issues. We, like you, want this to be Oregon engaged, not Oregon defined by an urban area or a valley area or a coastal area. We want to engage all of Oregon.
Thank you. You've given me a very good idea.
Thank you.
Well, I guess I would ask the group, the task force, maybe as you develop your strategy for how you're going to make sure you hit everyone in different regions around the state, keep the legislature informed, if that would be okay, and perhaps some of our colleagues have ideas that might be a benefit to you. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I was just going to make the observation that maybe somebody that you might want to spend a little time chatting with is Ken Rocco. This committee undertook a large trip around the state that was logistically, I think, very, very challenging. And it was my observation, and I think colleagues would bear this out, that we had many more people come than were able to speak. Even though the co-chairs tried to stay rigorously within 2 minutes, it's difficult when people feel passionately about an issue. And folks that didn't get a chance to speak or were cut off after a very finite period of time, I think felt less satisfied than had the meeting not occurred. And I think I would also have my colleagues agree with me that in part of our responsibilities as legislators, we end up doing a lot of case management. And I can tell you the hours that I've spent, and I'm sure it's an experience paralleled by everybody here, these are not cases that resolve themselves easily with 2 minutes at the microphone and thank you. People want to tell their story, and their stories are unique, unbelievably legally complicated. And I'm just concerned how you not have people snaked out around the building waiting to speak, and they're disappointed, and then they're disenfranchised with the outcome because they don't feel as though they've had a turn at bat. I think managing these meetings is going to be very complicated, but I would commend you to a lengthy conversation with Mr. Rocco, who may enlighten you on how well Ways and Means on the Road went.
You have to have a target to shoot at, is what I learned on the
road. Do I take that as a motion for an increase in funding? An increase in funding for the big look or for poor Mr. Rocco?
Mr. Redman, did you want to comment on that? That was mostly a comment.
Well, Chair Schrader, Senator Johnson, I appreciate the suggestion. We'll talk to Mr. Rocco, and any of you who have suggestions in terms of how to engage with particular communities throughout the state, we'd be happy to hear that input, and as the chair suggested, we'll stay in touch with this committee over time.
Senator Corby, first.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Three quick questions for you. The consultant that you're working with, is that an Oregon consultant, someone who really knows the territory, so to speak? Secondly, I believe I heard you say there was a plan to call 450 Oregonians. The sample size. And that leads me to ask, how many Oregonians still have landlines versus cell phones? And what are your assumptions around all of that? And then also, how effective are newspaper inserts in getting people out for meetings? And again, what are your assumptions around that approach?
Good questions.
If I may, Chair Schrader, I can help, and Richard can add in here. Senator Gordley, we've had a past relationship with John Pregonesi and Associates, which is a Portland-based firm. John was planning director in Woodburn, City of Ashland, and for about 8 years at Metro. He's been in private practice since the early 90s, I believe, 94 approximately. If we're able to continue, we would like to continue his firm's involvement. A public opinion poll, 450 Oregonians, and you're correct to point out there is a problem today where many people have cell phones, and many Oregonians or many citizens throughout the nation are unwilling to accept phone calls from public opinion research. It makes it more difficult. It doesn't make it impossible, and we would work to have this geographically balanced throughout the state of Oregon. I'm biased, of course, because I practice print journalism and also have taken over an aggressive form of web advancement. We think that as we see our newspaper readership increasing since spring by over 17%, that Oregonians are deeply committed to their community, to their neighborhoods, to their local issues, and we would utilize newspapers throughout the state of Oregon, both in community-based and diversity-based, to engage people where they live and where they're engaged in their communities. And we think by the message that would invite them to local meetings, that those that care about Oregonians, and there's thousands, would take time. And the fact that it's something printed separate, a special section, if they didn't have the time that day, that they could put it aside and come back to it. The web, in ways that we could engage young Oregonians and Oregonians engaged in sustainability issues, would be our target audiences. So diversity by geography, diversity by nature, and we think that through a variety of mechanisms, including an effort that I will make personally to the Oregon Association of Broadcasters and those that engage in television broadcasting, that we will invite Oregonians that choose not to read newspapers.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. Thank
good
you.
Question, good answers. All right, Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Cochise. Recognizing the time constraint, and it's the time constraint that you've emphasized the reason for July, August, and September, and yet, realistically, July and August specifically are not very good months to be doing any kind of town halls, meeting to try to reach the public. You know, truly those 2 months are where individuals are on vacation. September, the early part, is when individuals coming back to get their children in schools. So I would ask you to really think about that. Think about how you can maybe deploy your consulting resources and host those, even if you have to have more town halls in September, say, and maybe half some of them in October, because part of the objective here is to actually obtain input from around the state. And if we're going to put these kinds of limitations in the way, I don't think you're going to get what you're actually seeking.
Chair Schrader, Senator Winters, we are working under some significant time constraints here, and it's not an ideal situation. And we will do everything we can to try to push as much of that meeting effort outreach into the early fall. But Given the funding constraints, given the constraints of the summer on the one side and the election on the other, all I can say is we'll do the best we can with the hand that we've been dealt. It's not an ideal situation, but I think, as you've heard, we've got a variety of sources and media tools that we can use to get people interested and engaged in this, and I think we can make it effective, even with those constraints.
Mr. Bowles, even given the media instruments, those are the time of the year when no one's paying attention. You know, I'm just, those of us who've been in this, they're just not paying attention in the summertime. And I would just, you know, really just implore you to really think about how perhaps you can take September and the early part of October, do some compressing so that you're getting the bigger bang, even maybe looking at reconfiguring how your consultants are being used at that period of time. Because the objective is to get the statewide input and as much input as you can and to hear from the citizens of the state. So I just a thought.
Okay. Thank you.
What's it? Thank you, Commissioner Schrader. A comment, following up on Senator Johnson's comments, I think how much better it would have been in our Ways and Means tour had we divided up into groups, seven groups of three or five groups of four or whatever, and then listened to a lot more people giving them a long enough time to actually speak to us. And I would suggest that you might want to have a look at that too. They don't have to talk to your entire Big Look task force. They could be able to divide it up and have a longer time to converse.
Chair Schrader, Senator Whitsitt, that is actually part of the program. In addition to, just to be clear with everyone, so in addition to the meetings of and the outreach by the entire task force, the task force is also is going to divide up into small groups or in some cases individual task force members and have smaller meetings led by that individual or team of individuals. So it's a mix of types of meetings.
Very good. Yes, Representative Edwards, wind us up here.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate the thoughtful mix of qualitative and quantitative feedback. I'm curious in what order you intend to do the meetings versus the survey. I can foresee a number of scenarios. You could do a number of meetings and then do the survey in the middle, and then do follow-up with meetings based on the survey, in part on the survey results. You could do all the meetings up front and then do the survey at the end, kind of test the ideas that were generated during the meetings. You actually do the survey first to test ideas and then sound those out in the meetings. I'm just curious what arrangement you intend to pursue. We have to do public research, just for the record.
Imagine being in that caucus.
Chair Schrader, Representative Edwards, we've talked about this with the consultants, but I think it's still it's one of those things that still needs to be fine-tuned. I think the general intent right now is to do the meetings first, followed by the survey work. But that's part of the discussion of the timing in terms of when may drive that also.
Okay, thanks.
Very good. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm concerned with the comment that you made at the beginning of this discussion about the workload within the department laying the Big Look on top of the Measure 49, Measure 37 implementation stuff. And this may not be the forum for that discussion, but I would very much like to know what you see as the major challenges there and what the agency's plan is to address those kinds of things. I think that there is a lot of concern about the department taking on two huge projects concurrently and how that's going to be dealt with.
Chair Schrader, Representative Morgan, we do have two huge projects before us in terms of implementation for the Big Look Task Force and then Measure 49 implementation also. The highest priority for me right now, personally, in terms of the department, is to make sure that this Big Look task force gets re-engaged and gets pointed toward a successful conclusion at the end of this year. We do have a budget request, as you know, in also for Measure 49 implementation, where we have asked for the resources that we think we need to be able to provide timely relief to all the Measure 37 claimants out there as well. So we have asked for the resources we think we need to do both of these. And I just want you to know that I'm personally committed to making sure that this Big Look Task Force effort does not suffer by inattention because of work we're doing on Measure 49 implementation. This is very important.
Yeah, this would probably be a couple of good topics for check-ins over the rest of the interim with the agency and the staff. Just kind of make sure that they're staying on work plans for both of the projects.
Maybe one or more of our e-board meetings in the future. It's a very good idea. Staff will take care of that. Well, thank you. I want to, as co-chair, I just really appreciate the hard work you're doing. We're trying to work with you best we can, given our constraints. And it sounds like everyone is very excited about moving forward. And hopefully our forecast and whatever monies we can find, we will be able to make it an effective outreach. And so stay tuned. We'll have another conversation after February 8th.
Thank you very much.
Yes. I just echo that. I am extremely impressed with what you've come back to us as a proposal, and understanding that there are time and resource limits on any effort. I think the numbers you're talking about in terms of bringing into the process, providing a bit more information to them, and bringing a lot of input in is really impressive, and I think it will meet the legislature's objectives in terms of your public engagement responsibilities. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right, we'll go out of work session and into another more informal informational meeting and talk a little bit about affordable housing issues. It's been a topic of conversation. Michelle has gotten off, worked very hard to get back here to participate in the February session. I thank her for that and congratulate her on her efforts while she wasn't here, so we're successful. And let's get the appropriate people to come forward who need to talk about the Housing Alliance Initiative.
I believe you're going to hear about two proposals today, one of which is brought to you by the Housing Alliance, which is a short-term housing acquisition fund. The other is a proposal that will likely be discussed in the Revenue Committee, but it's being brought to you as information, and it's an expansion of the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, which is being forwarded by the Oregon State Housing Council. So they're not mutually exclusive, but they wanted you to see the whole picture.
I think that's important because the co-chairs called that out, as we might not be able to do both. Which of the two is most beneficial to this committee and to the members of the state legislature, and maybe to you all, too. So we're interested to hear from you.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bird, and I'm the Executive Director of the Neighborhood Partnership Fund, and I serve as the chair or convener of the Housing Alliance. The Housing Alliance is a coalition of more than 50 organizations concerned about the lack of housing options for low-income Oregonians and the effect that that lack of affordable housing has on our communities. And we appreciate your support and your willingness to hear this issue today. I'm going to talk about the Housing Alliance proposal, which was sponsored by Senator Betsy Johnson as Senate Bill 1073, and provide a little bit of context for the testimony today about housing preservation. To my right is Bill Van Vliet, who is the Executive Director of the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing, and he'll provide a little more detail about the Housing Acquisition Fund part of that proposal. And then Rick Krager, who is the Deputy Director of Housing and Community Services, will speak on behalf of the State Housing Council about a related proposal that they've brought forward. So Senate Bill 1073 would allocate $2.75 million in general fund for two purposes. The first would be $2 million for the preservation of existing rent-subsidized housing. and $750,000 would support efforts to end and prevent homelessness. So beginning with the proposal to support efforts to end and prevent homelessness, this would be a one-time request that would help to jumpstart local efforts to develop plans to end homelessness. So far, 9 counties across the state have worked on plans. The planning process, what we've seen is that that process has been a catalyst to engagement of the broader community and has spurred some really creative joint efforts to meet the needs of the most vulnerable citizens in our communities. The work would be done over the 18 months remaining in the biennium and would not increase staff at Housing and Community Services. So the two parts of that proposal would provide centralized support for local efforts through a consultant, coordination between counties so that we could learn from one another's progress, and then small grants of about $16,000 each to support local community-based efforts. We ask your support of this proposal. We know that these plans will encourage community partners to work together to better align existing systems and address homelessness, the need for treatment of addictions, mental illness, hunger, and other conditions of poverty. We also know that this effort is most needed in rural counties where this work has just not had the stimulus it's needed to go forward. So the other part of the proposal is asking for $2 million into what we're calling a housing acquisition fund. The housing acquisition fund would be a nimble interim purchaser that would allow us to work to preserve privately owned subsidized housing, which is coming up to the end of its contracts, the end of its use restrictions. We would put a first priority on the approximately 7,000 units in the state that have federal rent subsidy contracts which are scheduled to expire over the next 6 years. This housing is spread across the state. It was built over the past 40 years with financial support from 3 agencies, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Federal Rural Home or Rural Development, which was formerly called Farmers Home Agency, and from Housing and Community Services. It's located throughout the state in 32 counties and 45 house districts. Why is this housing important to save? First, we want to prevent the displacement of the current residents. We did, Neighborhood Partnership Fund, my organization, did a survey of 50 of these properties. And we showed in that sample of 50 properties, 28% of the residents are disabled, 60% are elderly, and all are extremely poor. We had an average household income of about $9,500 a year, so very low income. These folks have no ability or resources to allow them to move, and nowhere to move, even if they had the ability to. There's no replacement housing in the communities. The second reason to save this housing is to save the federal rent subsidy coming into Oregon. The rent subsidy contracts attach just to the units that we're estimating that we'd be able to impact with the housing acquisition fund are valued at approximately $12 million a year. The rent subsidy contracts allow residents to pay just 30% of their income for rent. So it's a pretty irreplaceable subsidy. Third, we can't afford not to. The replacement costs of these units would be at least 3 times what it would cost to save them, even if we assume rehab of the existing units. Even if we build new, we can't, within the affordable housing industry, build rents as low as what we would get with the federal rent subsidy contracts. And we don't have the ability to move the federal contracts from one building to another, typically. Occasionally it's allowed, but typically it's not. Fourth, and this is probably most important, we have a remarkable opportunity before us because of private foundation interest in and commitment to this issue. Meyer Memorial Trust has been a catalyst to this effort. They have committed funds to cover the administrative costs of the funds. They made one of the largest grants, maybe their largest grant ever, recently committed capital into the fund and administrative costs of the fund for 5 years. They've also been engaged in creating a steering committee that's working to attract other foundation funds. There's a proposal pending with the MacArthur Foundation that was submitted by Housing and Community Services. The state's general fund investment of $2 million would be matched by approximately $13 million in other foundation and local government resources, and that would in turn leverage $35 million in bank loans. In just a second, I'm going to turn this over to Bill Van Vliet, who will walk a little bit through the finances of the fund. But I want to emphasize that the interim fund is only part of a long-term solution. We need both an interim strategy, a nimble purchaser to act to save the properties, and we need a long-term financing strategy. And so it's not like $2 million into this fund is going to make us go away together altogether. We're going to need increasing resources to support the financing, which is typically done with the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, and we will need additional capital infusion, such as you put into the 07-09 biennium. There was $8.1 million of general fund allocated. That's pretty much already been allocated to projects, so we'll see in the 09-11 budget that we'll need to come back to you for gap financing. With that, I'm going to turn it to Bill Van Vliet, who's going to talk a little bit about the specifics of the fund.
Great. Excuse me. Thank you. Co-Chair Schrader and Co-Chair Nolan, members of the committee, my name is Bill Van Vliet, and I'm the Executive Director of NOAA, the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. And NOAA is a nonprofit loan consortium formed by the Oregon banks back in 1990 to finance affordable housing projects statewide. We've, to date, made about 115 loans, all on low-income apartment buildings, all rental projects. That's helped develop 5,200 units and $132 million in loans. Overall, those projects have put over half $1 billion of development costs into our state's economy during that time. NOAA will be the administrator of the Housing Acquisition Fund and will also be the administrator for the larger preservation initiative, of which the fund is one piece. As Janet referenced, this is a new fund, and it's an important first part of the larger preservation strategy. The purpose of the fund is to provide capital to facilitate acquisitions by projects by buyers who are dedicated to maintaining the long-term affordability provided by the federal rent assistance. So why do we need this? Well, many current owners of projects with expiring rental assistance wish to sell their properties. Assembling permanent financing packages with new contracts for these projects takes a considerable amount of time, placing buyers committed to affordability at a significant disadvantage to market rate purchasers who can act much more quickly. This fund will allow for more rapid acquisitions and allow affordable housing providers to compete with market investors for the acquisition of these projects. So we're seeking a $2 million state investment into this fund as seed capital. And that's, as Jenna said, going to help attract up to $13 million worth of equity-level financing from foundations in local jurisdictions. And together, that $15 million will help leverage an additional $35 million of private bank capital. And NOAA has a network of banks that we work with every day. They provide us already with $118 million worth of credit facilities for our regular programs, and we have interest expressed from them that they're interested in participating in this program as well. So that $2 million in seed capital helps produce a $50 million fund. Private foundations recognize the importance of preserving these housing units with the valuable rental assistance contracts because these units serve our most vulnerable citizens in every corner of the state. But they also don't feel the solution rests only with philanthropy. The Meyer Memorial Trust has been a very strong supporter of this initiative and has taken a leadership role, and they've committed $1.2 million in grant funding to help administer this program. They've also committed $4 million towards the fund, as Janet said. But they're also reserving $2 million of that $4 million until other equity resources are committed as to participate in the program. The MacArthur Foundation has a national preservation initiative specifically to deal with the issue that we're facing here in Oregon. And they require funding requests to be submitted by public jurisdictions, which is why Oregon Housing and Community Services Department submitted the application to MacArthur on behalf of our larger program. They want public participation in the solution. And we're seeking $5 million for the fund from MacArthur, and we're seeking another $1 million for administrative allocation for the fund as well from MacArthur.
A commitment of state resources opens the doors to capital funding from foundations such as MacArthur and Meyer, and without these equity sources in the fund, the bank participation levels, and thus the fund, shrinks considerably. The fund will be a revolving fund, and we anticipate the $50 million will revolve three times during the most critical 6 years of this program. That means that this initial $2 million investment generates a total of $150 million of capital that we can use to acquire projects. At that level, we believe we can acquire over 2,700 units to preserve, and these units bring in over $12 million per year in federal rental subsidies. As Jen said, to replace these units could cost over $250 million of new public resources. The initial acquisition of these projects is only the first step. The second step involves obtaining new federal contracts for the projects and new permanent financing to pay off these acquisition loans. And when those acquisition loans are repaid, they go back into the fund and we go out and buy more projects. Those permanent structures will require additional public resources, including the OHTC, as well as additional gap funding like the $8 million you approved last session. This is a statewide issue, and we need state support for the solution, both short-term and long-term. And we need the tools, such as the Acquisition Fund and the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, to preserve these affordable housing units. And by preserving them, we keep vulnerable citizens in their homes and in their communities. We have to understand that in a lot of smaller communities, these projects are the only affordable housing projects that exist, and losing them means they would be displaced not just from those units but from those communities as they search more affordable housing. We keep over $12 million of federal rental assistance flowing into Oregon annually, and we keep from spending over $250 million to replace the lost units. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next on our hit parade, please. Please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rick Krager. I'm the Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services. Nice to see all of you again here in Salem. First of all, I want to start out by saying that Oregon Housing Community Services completely supports the proposal that you just heard here today. Again, a $2.75 million request, the biggest portion of that to provide $2 million to leverage another $48 million for a pool of money to be used to preserve federally subsidized housing projects that are going, again, like has already been said, begin expiring over the next 6 years. Again, we're looking at a population of probably nearly 7,000 units of affordable housing that could be lost. This is a great public-private partnership that would allow us to provide, or I should say allow NOAA to provide interim financing for these projects. Many cases, it's not easy for me to say this, but affordable housing is complicated. In terms of doing permanent financing, sometimes we're looking up to 10 to 15 different resources. You're talking about tax credits, you're talking about tax-exempt bonds, you're talking about home grants, you're talking about a variety of other resources that come together to put it to do permanent affordable housing. It's complicated. So it takes time to put these particular deals together. There is a need to have a resource that can quickly preserve these properties. And I always use the example, and I know I talked to Senator Johnson about this, but the example of a project in Seaside, Oregon, that was at risk. You had a seller that was ready to get out of this particular project. We needed to have a resource that could quickly purchase that. Before the last session, there was no available quick resources, and what happened was we were able to provide a loan through Enterprise with a loan guarantee from Housing Community Services that preserved that for a short term. Then that project was able to come to the department with a proposal for long-term financing, which included Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. It included grant money from our consolidated funding cycle, and I'm happy to say that we preserved that for the long term. We got a 20-year HUD contract, and those federal subsidies are now still in this state. So it is critical that there be a quick response fund in place. Now, as I mentioned, there's two parts to this. The fund that comes in that has been proposed to you here today is going to require at some point a takeout. It's going to require some form of financing that would preserve this for the long term. To date, in just a little bit of history, during the last legislative session, the legislature approved a Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit that went from $11 million to $13 million. There was a request to take that from $11 million to $15 million. In addition, there was another very important change in that legislation, and that was to allow the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit to be used to preserve these federally subsidized housing projects. Couldn't use it before that. So we got that particular increase from 11 to 13. In addition, like has already been stated here today, that there was an $8 million resource that the Budget Committee approved for Oregon Housing Community Services that provided gap financing. So, again, very appreciative of those resources, and this is for the Preservation Initiative. What we've been able to do, we pulled up our sleeves, we went to work, and I'm happy to say that we preserved 1,600 units. We've committed resources for 1,600 federally subsidized housing projects through approximately 25 cities in this state. We've worked very hard. It's been very popular. The Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit has worked. Here's the problem. We have run up against that particular limit at this point. Now's where I'm going to change hats for here just a minute. I need to say that I'm going to speak on behalf of the State Housing Council. They are our body in terms of policy making. And back in November, we presented them with our status report on where we were at with our Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. At that time, the State Housing Council said, this is a problem. We need to speak to the legislature. They allocated a $2 million increase. There was a $4 million requested last month. We need to tell them of the situation. And so the State Housing Council, and I apologize for them not being here today. They wanted to be, but was unable to make it. What they have proposed is a tax credit increase for this biennium to help in terms of the preservation, the long-term preservation of units. Based on our data, we see approximately 1,800 units that are going to expire. These are federal contracts that will expire in the next year. So those are that's the population at risk. Now, part of the solution could be a quick response, such as the pool that has been provided, or at least the proposal that's been given to you here. You could have the $50 million for a short-term fix. That's only going to go to get you so far. And in addition, that short-term pool is going to need a long-term takeout at some point. Like Bill was talking about, the hope is that this can turn over three times over the next 6 years. Well, at the end of those 2 years, there needs to be a resource that will ultimately take that out. And the resource that that has been effective so far is the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. So I guess in conclusion, I just say the State Housing Council, on behalf of the State Housing Council, they would like to at least make you aware that there are 1,800 units at risk over the next year. They truly support the $2 million request that's that you've heard already, but they also beg you to consider looking at an increase in the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit that will provide you the permanent, long-term, I want to emphasize that long-term solution that will preserve these properties and the federal subsidies in the state. So thank you very much, and more than happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Crager. Excellent job. Good presentation. Senator Johnson and Senator Whitsitt.
Mr. Crager, I just want to make sure that we all understood the numbers that you were telling us. If I understood Ms. Bird's testimony correctly, and it's the research that I've done in preparing the bill, we're talking about 7,000 units of seven, maybe more, up to nine, that could be preserved by the $2 million.
The $2 million, actually, our estimates are that over the 6 years, we would touch 2,700 units. The pool of at-risk units, excuse me, is approximately 7,000. Not all of those are likely to come for sale. We can't necessarily predict. And some may come straight to the department and not come through the interim pool.
What I'm trying to get here, though, is a sense of scale. Mr. Crager, you talked about the tax credit affecting 1,800 units versus as many as 7,000 the other way. What I'm trying to figure out, and here's my question, Mr. Crager, given that we're going to know a lot more on Friday what our whole world looks like, if you had to pick right now, knowing that we may not be able to do everything, both of these are laudable and worthy, and we can't do everything, what do we do?
N- Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, excellent question. I think,
and there's the answer delivered. Just
obviously, both of these initiatives are very important, and I do want to emphasize they complement each other, they work together. I think certainly as there is a need for some resources that are going to address the 1,800 units that are coming due in the next year. The question is, what is the best resource to take care of that? The $50 million pool will address some of that.
The pool created by
the $2 million,
by 1073.
The $2 million. It will address that. How much of that will address? I'm going to kind of peek over here to my colleagues, but I'm assuming about approximately 700 units that that in the next year you would be able to preserve. Is that correct?
It's 909, according to the data.
909. Sorry. So 909 of those units, based on the projections that they provided, that still leaves 800 units potentially at risk. They are contracts are going to be expiring. Now, let's turn the table. Let's say, well, you use the tax credit resources to be the answer, that we go with a tax credit increase. As I mentioned to you earlier, doing affordable housing doesn't happen quickly. I have a great staff, and they work extremely hard, but will I be able to preserve all 1,800 of those units if you give me a tax credit increase without some kind of support for a short-term pool? Probably not. I guess that's why we see this as a joint solution. We've got to work together to come up with two processes that will enable us to get as much as those 1,800. And again, I'm just targeting 1 year. I haven't even started talking about 2009, 2010, 2011, and so on and so forth. But to answer your question, Senator Johnson, I mean, you want me to make a choice.
If you don't make the choice, we will. We assume you're slightly more informed than us, so we should give that opportunity now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I think that the $2 million I think if there were some ways in which we could get maybe both.
I don't think you're hearing us very well, Mr. Krieger.
Mr. Chairman, let me explain myself. In terms of the maximum amount of resources that you're willing to commit to an affordable housing proposal, if there was a way, because again, you're looking at two proposals that work together. So if you're willing to come up with this is X amount of dollars that we're willing to do. If there was a way to look at, you recognize there's two needs here, and maybe give a little bit to both. I think that's one answer.
Within 3 weeks, we hope you are able to do that within the $2 million or so that we put on the docket.
Yes.
Can I do a follow-up? The difficulty that I see with splitting the baby that way is, do you cripple both programs? I mean, I know that we always have a tendency as legislators to try to find out a little win for everybody. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to figure out, do you keep Meyer Memorial at the table? I think it's remarkable that Meyer has stepped up in the way that they have, and I don't know whether or not Meyer goes away. The perfect intersection is business, philanthropy, and government, in my observation, and we have philanthropy at the table in a way, creating policy and giving at a level that I haven't seen in this state before. Do you keep Meyer at the table?
Do you want to address that?
All right.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, I think the advantage to having the full amount go into the Housing Acquisition Fund, and that is the priority of the Housing Alliance, though we recognize the value of the OHTC, we also have the opportunity to leverage not only Meyer but MacArthur, and I see that as sort of a huge political coup on a national level. I think we need HUD to behave in this, and one of the things Senator Whitsitt asked a question, why do we project a capital gap of between $11 million and $150 million? It's, does HUD behave or not? And I think if the more philanthropic involvement we have, the more opportunity we have to leverage that sort of national political attention. That being said, I think, you know, we are clearly all in a quandary, and I feel sorry that Mr. Krieger got the question before I did, because I probably would have struggled almost as much. But the Housing Alliance priority is the Senate Bill 1073 proposal.
Senator Whitsitt, you had a question.
Thank you, Chair Schrader. First, I'd like to just compliment you on your work. I think this preservation of existing housing is certainly the best buy that we have in the near future on the horizon. Two questions, actually. Could you provide a few examples of the positive outcomes in reducing homelessness in the 9 counties that have completed the coordinated planning process?
I'd be happy to. The ones I'm most familiar with actually are the 3 Portland metro counties, Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington County. One of the things that my organization does is manage it's a 4 county, it's also Clark County in Washington State, program to end family homelessness with high need chronically homeless families. And what we've seen coming out of the even just the simple act of trying to more accurately count the number of homeless families is just a real outpouring of community commitment to address the problem. And I know I'm familiar a little bit as well with the efforts in Lincoln County, and we've seen the same kind of just community coalescing around the notion that families and children in particular should not be homeless, as well as compassion for people who have chronic mental illness and other illnesses and disabilities that keep them from being stable.
Thank you. Follow-up, please.
Yes, follow-up.
This is for Mr. Krager. On your projection for cost per unit, we've plowed this ground before, but $190,000 per unit, I don't know how you could spend that much. And, you know, that's $380,000 for a duplex, $750,000 for a fourplex. The old rule of thumb is, you can't invest more than 100 months rent return. That would be $1,900 a month, even at 150 months, you're at almost $1,300 a month. So if the private sector can build these and rent them for something that's not in the affordable $400 or $500 a month, but in a $750-$800 a month range, why can't we?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitsitt, first of all, let me just add to one of the things that Janet said. I think you were looking for real, true outcomes in terms of the planning piece of homelessness. And I think one of the things that Janet also, I think part of the what we've seen in Portland is, and I don't have the exact number, and maybe Janet correct me, but nearly 60% reduction in the chronic homeless. So in terms of the changes that they've made have been phenomenal. And I've been in Washington, D.C. at these Corporation for Supportive Housing conferences, and Portland is recognized as one of the truest leaders in doing this. And again, that's something we want to replicate across the state. To your second question, I think we have advantage of having a banker here in Bill Van Vliet, and I think he could probably give you a little bit more complete answers than the intricate details of the new the cost per unit for new construction versus that of acquisition or rehab.
Thank you, Rick. Senator Whitson. There are some reasons. There has been a chronic tension within our industry over this issue. There's no doubt about it. The costs are high. We know that. We struggle with it. I can give you a couple of answers and then some real specifics on some areas where the costs are higher. I mean, first of all, the department does monitor costs during every application that comes in for funding. So there is a very vigorous competition for resources, and cost to construct is one of the criteria that goes into that evaluation for a funding award. So there is a natural built-in process to try and incent people to keep the cost down. But that being said, they are creeping up and they're very high. A few years ago, NOAA did a study on some cost comparisons for a housing policy board down in Eugene, and we compared the private sector multifamily with low-income developers in the Oregon area and did those comparisons. And to make a long story short, there was really not a great discernible difference in the construction costs between those two groups. A couple of the areas that stand out why the costs are higher, the affordable housing developments are often built to house large families. So we're building a lot more bedrooms per unit than a private developer typically will. There are NIMBY issues to overcome with affordable housing. So we have to dress up these projects a little bit to get get them cited, or they get we draw a tremendous amount of community opposition. There is a social service provision required for every affordable housing project, and with that you need space to deliver those social services on site. So there are large community rooms, often filled with computer banks. There's child care programs. There's a number of different services that drive up the capital costs of developing those projects. Another thing is these projects in Oregon tend to be relatively small, 30 to 50 units. For-profit developers are building 300 units or more at a shot. There's economies of scale, and it just is a natural fact that our projects don't have those many extra units to disperse some of the fixed costs over. And then there's some very specific costs germane to affordable housing development. There's programs, there's fees that have to be developed. There's professional services that are very extensive because it's very highly technical financing with limited partnerships and tax law consequences, and those add in. And a normal developer does not have to incur those when they're out there building small plexes on an infill site.
One good follow-up.
Good answer, actually.
Yes, that was very useful. I appreciate that. Could you give us a rough example of the rough estimate of the administrative costs that you just spoke about last, on a percentage basis?
For a project?
Yes.
I'd have to speculate because I have too many numbers swimming around in my head. I'd rather follow up on get you a more precise number than to just quote
Thank
one.
You.
Okay.
It's more than me.
Let's see, Co-Chair Nolan next, then Senator Gordley, and then Senator Bates.
A couple questions for clarification. Mr. Krieger, on the 60% reduction in homelessness outcome you quoted, what was the cost of achieving that outcome?
Madam Chair, I'll be honest with you. I'd want to follow up with you. I mean, that's City of Portland information, and I'd be more than happy to provide that in terms of the actual. You're talking about the actual investment into that reduction.
What I'm getting at is, would we expect that kind of return for $16,000?
Madam Chair, I think that what we have seen in terms from a national standpoint with these type of investments for local planning, I'm just using Michigan as an example, that have all 72 counties now on a local plan, they've seen significant statewide results. I think they're at 40% reduction in chronic homelessness. So each and every county, it's a complete new focus in terms of addressing the issues. So would we see the same results as Portland? I can't guarantee that, but I can tell you would see significant reductions in issues of homelessness when you start looking at systems, reorienting systems, and addressing the problem, ending the problem, as opposed to coming up with a quick fix.
My point is, thank you, I don't doubt that you can achieve that kind of result if you do a thorough plan that is feasible and then you actually follow through and implement it. But I wonder whether you can really hope to get that kind of return for what I understand to be basically a $16,000 investment per county. Maybe a small population county might be able to get some real results for that, but I doubt that very many of our counties could. And so I just put that back to you, and if you want to get back to me on that, that would be helpful. Another follow-up, Mr. Co-Chair?
Please, Madam Co-Chair.
I don't know who to address this question to, probably Mr. Van Vliet or Ms. Berg. I'm trying to understand the loan fund. On many levels, if we have to play Solomon, that's appealing to me because it's a one-time investment, whereas a tax credit is an ongoing one. On the other hand, it's essentially a two-year loan we're talking about. So my questions would relate to what happens to that property and those units after 2 years. What kind, do we have any commitment at all from the purchaser to retain those properties in low income rental range? Whereas when they were originally built, in order to get federal support, they signed a 20 or 30 year enforceable contract. Do we get any kind of enforceable contract in the bridge loan?
and for how many years would it be?
Thanks. Yes, Co-Chair Nolan. So there's a couple, I think a couple of ways that we get there. First of all, most of these short-term holds, the federal contract will still be in effect. And so the federal restrictions and the people currently living in those units will still be there. So the question is, what happens at the end of that contract when it expires, which in theory is at about that two-year period, is what we're thinking. Is there a guarantee? There is not a guarantee other than the people who we are going to be working with to do the acquisitions are all community-minded and committed to housing affordability. And my assumption is that with the fund, we will put a requirement in that requires them to use their best efforts to obtain the long-term affordability and not opt out of the program. What is happening today in some parts of the state is that there are developers from out of state, owners, investors coming in buying these projects, stepping into the existing contracts with 3 or 4 years remaining with the full intention of terminating the contracts at the end of that period and flipping these to market rate projects. So we're already in the process of losing some. Our goal is to work with nonprofits and housing authorities around the state as well as civic-minded for-profit developers who are going to be committed to long-term affordability. So we'll put that in. But there has to be a way for that project to cease being affordable if there is some termination of the subsidies that make the project affordable. For instance, if there is not the capital, the gap funding that comes through, or if the federal programs are ceased to be funded at the end. So we wouldn't overlay a 30-year requirement and hold them to it if, for some reason, the means of achieving that affordability didn't materialize because of other public decisions that are made.
One quick follow-up, and then I'll turn it over to someone else. If you're working mostly with nonprofit organizations to purchase these buildings, is it fair to assume then they're not motivated by the Affordable Housing Tax Credit?
They are motivated by that because the Affordable Housing Tax Credit is delivered through the banks, and the banks are motivated by it. It's an interest rate reduction in the financing that then the banks turn around and collect in the form of a state income tax credit. So a bank will make a loan that normally would be at 7%, they'll make it 3%, and you can imagine how that helps sort of the buying power on these projects. Then for their lost interest income, for only receiving 3% instead of 7%, they claim in the form of a state income tax credit. So that's how that gets delivered into the system. So the nonprofit doesn't need it, but the bank does.
Thanks.
Very good. Senator Burley, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Two questions, possibly three. We're talking here about a policy and backed by an investment that will meet the needs of the low-income Oregonians who are in dire straits already. What would be the cost of not making the two-prong investment? I'm calling it two prongs. What would be the cost of not doing it? One question. Also, do we know how many veterans and or veterans-headed households would be affected? Again, I'm looking at that 7,000 number of current rent-subsidized housing.
Mr. Kutcher, Senator Gordley. To answer the second question first, it's actually quite difficult because of fair housing laws to get a lot of detail about the residents other than what I've shared with you. So I don't have information, for example, about the specific nature of disabilities. I don't have great information about race and other ethnic populations, and I don't have information about whether folks are veterans or not. And I shared with you the income and other kinds of information I have. In terms of the impact, though, we know that in many communities, particularly the rural development projects, this may be the only multifamily housing within those communities. And so if it's lost to this rich subsidy program, the deep subsidy, we can assume that people will become homeless or at the very least be dislocated from their communities. There really is no substitute housing. We also know that the rental market across the state is tightening up right now. Vacancy rates are significantly lower. And so given the affordability of these, the connection to the deep rent subsidy that we can't replace, we can only assume that we would be seeing significant homelessness or folks having to double up if we lose these units.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gorley, just to add to what Janet said, these particular projects, they are serving 30% area median income, and let me just put that in context for you. What that is $17,000 to $22,000 per year. That's how much a family makes that lives in this house. Mm-hmm. So without that rent subsidy, you can kind of imagine what, from a social service standpoint, where there might be needs. I know that when we met with the Revenue Committee a few weeks ago and talking about the tax credit, Department of Human Services joined us as well and talked a little bit about their concerns as it relates to if these people aren't housed and stabilized. And one of the things that we typically forget is that there's the built-in service component into many of these housing projects. So there are services that are offered as well in this. So without that infrastructure, where are they going to go? And I know that's one of the issues the Department of Human Services is very concerned about. I wish I could give you this grand cost in terms of what it would be if they're not housed, but DHS has reminded us that, you know, we really need to preserve these projects.
And I would just say briefly that we do, even though we may not be able to say what the dollar amount is, that it might be not to make the investment, we just need to realize that there will be a cost, and the cost is in the quality of life for families as well as a cost associated with other services, higher caseloads in other areas that the state also pays for.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Senator Gorley actually brought my biggest concern already, but I want to put a little fine point on it if I can, if you don't mind, Senator Gorley. We're talking about a $2 million investment, and I understand that part of the program, the need to sort of short-term financing to get your long-term financing. DHS should be able to give you some figures on this. You should ask for that.
Mm-hmm.
You bump your caseload up 1,000 or 2,000 families in TANF, in OHP, in real programs. It's way past $2 million really fast.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really fast. And long term, those kids aren't going to school probably.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get a job if you don't have a residence. So those people can't work. And the cost for letting this fall apart is going to be way past $2 million. This is a small investment for what I think you're going to get out of it, and DHS should step up and help you with that, because they'll be talking to us next week why their caseloads have gone up, because we didn't do this, and we make sure we connect those two dots. I have one question for you. I'd ask you to talk to DHS about that. I have one question, if I may, Mr. Co-Chair. Is it common practice in other states that you have to have a state tax credit in addition to the HUD dollars to make these projects pencil out? I would think that the federal government set the HUD program up to run basically clean, fairly. I know it's a huge bureaucracy. Our friends have done this. The bureaucracy they have to go through to get these things set up is huge. But usually with the HUD payments coming in and the rents that are paid by the individuals, they usually make these things, you know, at least break even. Is it necessary to have a state tax credit to maintain these programs in other states as well as ours? Is that a common practice?
Sorry,
can you do it?
Oh, yeah, I'll do it. Well, I'll do one part and do the other. Minute. If I don't, okay.
But we want to do it.
All right, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates. I guess this was, I think, a similar question that Representative Nolan had asked me at one point is, well, this has got to be happening around the nation. What are other states doing to address this? And do they put tax credits in these to effectively preserve them? What I will say about the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, very unique. Great tool to preserve affordable housing. What do other states do? Well, I can take example from our sister state, Washington. One of the things they've been able to do is leverage other resources. They have, I think, 3 document recording fees as well as general fund appropriation to the housing trust. They actually use specific dollars that go into it. For other states, housing finance agencies that just deal with housing, they have a very strong balance sheet, and they do investments. I think Alaska is an example where they're doing investments of nearly $20 to $30 million of their resources that are generated through their bond programs to actually invest into housing. So there's a variety of answers across the nation, just depending on what the housing finance agency or the state is taking on. But again, those are just a few examples. And Senator, I hope that answers your question. Maybe Bill, fill in any blanks.
In simple terms, what we're saying is most states have to do more than just the HUDs. They have some mechanism for putting more on the plate here. So that's answers the question. Thank you.
Very good. Senator Carter?
I just wanted to say, and I wanted these guys to see it, and I'm dating myself back when, but when we applied some years ago for federal funds, they would not give us federal funds without some state participation. So if you're going to have, if we're going to have tax credits in this state, then you're going to have some federal money as well as some state money to go with those dollars to complement the packaging that you're trying to get. So the state can't get out of this by not participating with some level of actual dollar in addition to the tax credit. So it's just a package piece that makes the difference. You can't have one without the other. You can have smaller packages, but you cannot have a complement of a program without a complementary package.
Well, I take 3 things away from the discussion. It's a very good discussion, and I appreciate Representative Edwards has a lot more insight than I. Please take.
Thank you, Mr. Kosher.
Yes, sir.
Just a quick question from Mr. Craig. If I understood you correctly, in answer to the question posed by Madam Co-Chair, you indicated the need for additional gap financing in the next biennium. I'm just curious if you have an estimate of the roll-up costs. Just to preserve the housing that would have been preserved if we funded.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, in terms of the cost for gap financing that would be necessary to preserve these type of projects, we've been able to use approximately $6 to $7 million of the resources that you were kind enough to allocate to allocate nearly 16, or to be able to preserve nearly 1,600 units. So if we do the math, in terms of another 1,800 units, you're talking, you know, another probably $8 million type investment to do the same type. Now, all these projects are so different. They're in different locations.
Understood.
So they vary in terms of the gaps, depending on what the market is. But again, that just to give you an idea, if you're looking at somewhere between 1,600 to 3,000 units on a biennium, you're looking anywhere between an $8 to $12 million investment.
And I would just follow up with that then, that every one of those projects that just went through with that $8 million did have the OHTC, and that has a phenomenal leveraging factor on the additional gap subsidy.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, just to add, my staff has done a great job of just throwing me the numbers here in terms of he's actually calculated the next 5 years as it relates to those in our estimate 4,600 units, and in the next 5 years you're talking about according to his estimate about a $17.2 million investment. So I was a little off. So I think it was a little high.
And I think it's a segue into. Ideally, this committee, I think, is the committee that looks to the future. We just don't budget for 2 years. It would seem that way. But I think we're looking. The questions from everybody have been about how do we manage the assets to maximum advantage? What are the increased costs and why? What's our plan? So I would think this might be something we want to follow up on a little bit during the interim also. And I'd say, to me, there's there's three key elements here that I guess that I come up with. One is that we should have an asset management plan. You know, you probably do or maybe do not. Some agencies do or do not. We've had this discussion with other investments. So it would be really good to have something that this body could feel pretty comfortable with, that we are, you know, getting the bang for the buck, if you will, and we're monitoring these projects at key intervals. The efficiency of the dollars invested continue to stay at X. If they start to tail off, that's something we want to know. The other thing it sounds like we need is, you've alluded to it here, which is a great document. I appreciate you coming forward with a six-year strategy type of approach, and the leveraging is phenomenal. The discussion, to me anyway, both carrying on with the tax credits and the immediate infusion of general fund dollars do it, that helps me. But I think it would be really helpful before we walk into 09 would be to have a six-year strategy laid out for us and how, what dates there are, what units we're going to buy up, why they're the units you're buying up at that time, the numbers that your staff is giving you. I mean, because we can show real outcomes here. And hopefully it'll translate into some of the things that Senator Gordley's talking about what's the average income level in these units, are we keeping people off of other homeless roles, these types of things. If we give you time, i.e. between now and 09, maybe we can have a real thoughtful plan. So when we walk into 09, we're not just doing 09-11, we're doing 11-13, 13-15. And the last piece is I think we need to work very closely with our revenue committees. I mean, obviously, there's the short-term, long-term, and there does have to be balance. Maybe right now we're constrained. We may have to make a Hobbesian choice this February session. But in the future, I'd like to have a much more thoughtful strategy where, you know, we're doing things in a timely manner that you feel are getting not only us the bridge financing, if you will, but the long-term solutions with some, you know, much akin to Fed's play ball. I appreciate what Phil's saying on that. But I think if we can get that sort of discussion going between now and 09, then the confidence level of this group and hopefully coordination with the revenue group will have a very clear strategy for how we make the investments. So I appreciate the work you've done and the documentation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
I appreciate what you're saying, but I want to make sure that we're also acknowledging that there's an investment that needs to be made in 08 to take care of some needs that exist right now. And that, yes, we do need to do the other piece, looking ahead to 09. I'm just hoping that we're also saying we need to make a commitment now, February, 08.
Year of our Lord.
Further discussion. Appreciate it, Ms. Patient. I guess that's it for today. Thank you very much. Great presentation. Good discussion. Anything else before the body? Seeing none?
No.
Adjourn for the day.